On this episode of the iFilmmaker podcast, we're talking with filmmaker and entrepreneur Alex Ferrari, who has so many titles that I'm not even going to try to mention them all. Welcome back to the iFilmmaker podcast. My name is Ariel Martinez, and little by little, I'm getting our groove back here on the iFilmmaker podcast. Thank you to everyone that has been loyal and waiting for this to happen. Today we have our good friend Alex Ferrari. If you don't remember our last episode, it was phenomenal. Alex is a genius when it comes to like business and filmmaking and kind of meshing those two worlds together. He has a lot of more knowledge to drop on this episode, and I like to let Alex go off and let everything out and just kind of pick his brain. He has so much information, and for sure he'll be back on the show, but we have a good nice hour long or so conversation about becoming an entrepreneur as a filmmaker and how basically, you know, you can take your own film, your own projects and monetize it yourself without the help of outside sourcing and, you know, not having to worry about people taking advantage of you when you're trying to distribute your stuff and kind of make money on that end. So Alex has a new book out called The Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. I hope I said that right, The Filmtrepreneur, which is really cool. I'm digging it. I love the fact that he has it on Audible, which is usually how I kind of taken and read, or I guess listen to all my books. So I'm definitely going to be picking it up there. And for those of you that want links to everything that's going to be mentioned on this episode, I'm going to be putting all of that over on the show notes for this show over at ifilmmaker.tv. The podcast could also be accessed from my website, arielmartinez.tv. It's all going to be right there. You can leave your notes there, everything. It's all going to be posted. So without further ado, here is Alex Ferrari. How have you been? It's been a while.
Well, yeah, man, it's been a while. Nothing's going on. Nothing's really very, very boring.
I can't imagine.
The life is simple, you know, everything usual.
Yeah. Well,
that's crazy, man.
Yeah, I know, man.
We're living in the Matrix, brother.
Yeah, we are. We really are. It's insane how things have changed since last time we spoke, but this is obviously crazy circumstances. You're in LA right now. What's it like over there? What's the atmosphere over there like?
Well, first of all, the atmosphere is clean, so you could actually see stuff because the smog is gone.
Yes.
I was driving around on the weekends. My wife and I take my daughters, just put them in the car and just drive. We don't get out. We just drive so we can get another point of view to change the scenery so we don't feel like we're completely under house arrest in the quarantine. But when we were driving around, I'm like, my God, those mountains look cleaner than I've ever seen them. Like it's just – it's pretty insane how much damage we do with our pollution in the city, and it's pretty remarkable. We were driving in Griffith Park here, which is I think the largest city park in the country.
Okay.
And we're driving by a golf course and there's deer. Whoa. Like deer grazing on the golf course.
Have you ever seen that before?
No, absolutely not. No, it's like I was seeing pictures from Central
Park.
Makes
me think of like an I Am Legend type of scenario.
No, well, we're not too well. Anyway, it's getting there. Well, when there's no people, animals and nature will come back.
Yeah.
So if in Central Park there's pictures of the squirrels, they're just taking over the park. They're on their back in the middle of it. Like they're doing things that they never would do because people aren't there. It's pretty remarkable. But the vibe here is what it is, man. We're one of the larger places. Our mayor and our governor have been amazing. They locked this thing down early, and the numbers are starting to show that. So people are scared.
I think that's one of the things that unfortunate events like this, catastrophic events like this, it's horrible. But I think oftentimes it brings out the best in people. Like you start seeing a lot of people start helping each other. Like I myself have been trying to contact at least the elders of my church, and trying to see if if you know, they need any assistance and whatnot. And I know others have been doing the same thing. Everyone is basically banding together and trying to kind of combat this in their own different ways. There's a lot of GoFundMes. There's a lot of things going on right now that have a lot of people, you know, helping each other. And obviously, you see a lot of the content creation has spiked. A lot of the online stuff has spiked. Like, everyone is literally starting a podcast right now. Everyone's starting a YouTube channel. Everybody is trying to get into that right now.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, I've started seeing the numbers go, and I'm starting seeing new podcasts and new YouTube videos coming out. And I'm like, hey, man, more the merrier. Hey, look,
dude, it's absolutely. It's great.
But one thing that you and I have in common is we both are from Miami.
Yes.
And we've been through hurricanes. I've been through multiple hurricanes. Like, Andrew, devastating, you know, like a devastating 2 weeks without power. And it's kind of like a much smaller, it's not smaller, it's a very more intense version of what we're dealing with now. But now, as opposed to feeling like you're isolated, like, you know, right. In LA, they're still LA. They're doing what they're doing. The whole world, it's like, is feeling the exact same thing you're feeling. So it's kind of like going through that hurricane, but not over a one Man, night or two crazy. Night, but like two, not that 2 week process that it's like everything. So yeah, when the hurricanes used to come, you see people, like the neighbors start coming out, you start talking to people. It's similar, but now you can't even talk, like get close to people, which is even additional
thing. It's so conversation has even changed, right? Like, my first question to you is how has your life changed, basically? How are you handling Corona? Are you still working? Do you still have a job? Like, it's definitely changed what we talk about. Like, no one's talking about sports. No one's talking about anything else but this. Like, this is the conversation.
This is the conversation. And I think it's the first time in the entire world, time in the history of the world, where the entire world is doing the same thing. The entire world is talking about this. And, if there's comedy troupes doing skits right now around the world, they're doing things about Corona. Like, it's just it's the thing. And I think, you know, even 9/11, to a certain extent, people were talking about it, but it didn't affect everybody. Like, it's affecting the entire planet now. It is a once in a lifetime, once in a generation thing we're going through. And I've been talking a lot about on my podcast and on my content that I've been creating, how this is going to affect us as an industry. And it is pretty,
what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that I've been talking and yelling from the top of the mountain for as long as I can, that the world is going to change. Our industry is going to change. I've been seeing it in the tea leaves for over a year now, if not longer, that I felt that our entire industry was basically on a house of cards, and that the studio system was extremely leveraged, and that they've basically being held up by the foreign market, specifically China. But the foreign market, so if you remember, you know, when we were growing up, the theatrical box office percentages was basically like a 70-30, which was 70 US, 30 the rest of the world, where now it's the other way around. It's more like a 70-30 the other way, where the US market now is 30% of the income, and the rest of the world is kind of supporting these big, bloated, monster event tentpole films. But the thing was that the second that other nozzle gets turned off, like China shut down, all the theaters shut down, when that nozzle got turned off, the house starts to shake. And I've been saying for a long time as well that out of the six big studios, I feel that only three of them are going to probably survive this next incarnation of our industry, which are Disney, Warner's, and Universal, whereas Paramount, Sony, and Lionsgate, they're very vulnerable because they don't have the IPs. They don't have the infrastructure. Like, everyone's trying to be Disney. Yeah. You know, Disney hasn't been in the movie business for a long time. They are in a whole other business. And if you look at their corporate filings and all that stuff, 80% of the money they make is outside of actually movie production. It's pretty, but movie production kind of is the engine that keeps the rest of the machine going, but the revenue stream is outside of the actual production or exhibition of the film. So Warner's has that to a certain extent, and Universal, and they're also diversified. Paramount's not diversified. Sony, if you read the book The Biz about the Sony hacks, you saw what's going on inside of that studio. They have no IP, really, no big IPs other than like James Bond that comes out every 3 or 4 years, and a few other ones that they, but nothing like Disney, nothing like even Warner Brothers or Universal. For sure. That's, I think that's on a grand macro scale. I kept saying, guys, we're in good economic times. Wait until we have a downturn and we're due and we're late, and what's going on economically. I still feel that we're just going through Corona. We haven't hit economic downturn yet, because there's still systematic problems in our financial system. There's a bubble there that will have, there will be a day of reckoning with that as well. So right now we're still, we're just getting the first punch of Corona, but when the other punch comes down, that's when we're really going to feel it. And I mean, look, in the history of the world, I've never heard of the entire planet shutting down economically, essentially.
No one has. No one has.
It's not something that any model, anybody can really prepare for. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm reading articles like AMC Theaters. They might not come back. What is that? Like how can, like, one of the biggest movie exhibitors in the U.S., if not the planet, how is that going to work? Like, they have all these theaters, like, someone's going to buy that. Someone's going to pick that up. Like, what's going to happen to AMC?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what's going to happen to Regal? And what's going to happen to all these other big movie theater chains? What's going to happen to our habits? Are we going to, like, I know personally, I'm not going to the movies this summer. Even if I got the A-OK, everyone, you know, Dr. Fauci shows up tomorrow and says, we good. We got a vaccine. We got some pills to take care of this stuff. No one's going to die no more. Even with that, there's still a hangover effect.
Of course. It's gonna take a long time for people to even get comfortable
being around people.
Basketball games, NFL games, like concerts, all that stuff that requires a lot of people congested in one place. It's not gonna come back as it was.
No, it isn't. And I think this is gonna be the first summer since summer blockbuster season started in the 70s that we're not going to have a blockbuster. We're not going to have I don't know what's going to happen to these tentpoles, because they can only push so many movies to the winter, to Christmas.
Well, yeah, everything is, it seems like everything, all these movies are being released digitally already. Like, every movie's already coming out on Netflix or for purchase, you know, to, well, you know, obviously that, with the big premieres, price tag. Well, yeah, they're doing premieres, $20. You know, which a lot of people are complaining about, but it's like, come on, it's a lot cheaper, and you're still helping the industry, I think. But man, it's a huge blow to everybody.
The reason why I think, this is my own personal opinion, why I think that the direct premium, I call it premium TOV, TVOD, mm-hmm. premium TVOD, which is that $19.99 price point for a one-time rental, essentially. The problem with that model is that it is in a platform that we're used to seeing things for free or part of our subscription or paying $4.99 or $6.99. So there's a big disconnect there. Unless it's a huge event film like Black Widow or an Avengers film or a Fast and Furious or something monstrous, then maybe that'll work. But I think in the long term, I don't know if it's going to work, not at that price point. And if that's the case, then how is the economics going to change? Like, can the studios afford to do a $200 million movie anymore, you know, in this kind of economic model? It's a weird thing. Man.
It's incredible. And I've never gotten into economics, and I was okay in economics in school, but I've never gotten into economics until this, like, in depth. And I started kind of seeing how this whole thing works. And it's amazing to see, like, the whole trickle down effect on how it affects everybody and everything.
It's massive.
Something as little as releasing a movie, you know, releasing movies now digitally vastly decreases the revenue, and if the revenue vastly decreases, the production vastly decreases, you know, and then the work vastly decreases. You can't afford to pay people what you were paying them before. What does that mean to me? Like, it, at the end of the day, it's going to come down to us, and we're going to either have to start charging less or kind of picking and choosing our with these battles. Because before, I mean, you can easily set your prices and your clients will pay that or not. But now it doesn't seem like a lot of people are going to be paying as much. Investors are not going to be investing as much in an industry that, I mean, it's very dim right now, you know?
Well, I mean, if you want to see where our industry is going to go, all you have to do is just study the music industry. This is the exact same thing that happened to the music industry. Okay. If you look at the music industry, originally to get a song would cost you $17, $18. Because if you wanted that, unless they released it as a single, you would have to buy the album, whether that be vinyl, tape, or CD. And right. Or just wait on the radio and record it off the radio when tapes came out. You know, back in the olden days that we used to do that. Right. But that was the cost to gain that content. Then they would release singles and it would be like a $4, you know, $3 or $4 for the singles because they'd have an A side and a B side. So they charge like $4 or $5 for that, whatever, right?
Right.
Then MP3 showed up and then that basically took the value away to free, essentially, for all content. But then, which was stealing, just to be very clear, it was stealing. Yeah. But then the industry couldn't fight that back. They were holding on so tightly to the way things were that they didn't take advantage of the way things were going to go. Because once Pandora's box was open, once the MP3 was out there, once people understood that that technology existed, they would never go back. They just wouldn't go back and in the grand scale. Sure. So then they came up with streaming audio. And now the studios are making a lot of money streaming audio because they have massive, massive libraries that they're selling off or giving the rights to these different platforms, Spotify, Amazon, and so on. But the artists are making nothing. So now, you know, I just heard Beyonce. Beyonce made like a tenth of a tenth of a cent per stream of her music. So if Beyonce is having that problem, what do you think the independent star or even mid-level or even somewhat recognizable musician is going to do? So now, unfortunately, that whole industry is basically there's a devaluation of content. So the content in the consumer's mind is essentially free. So for you to go out and pay, you're going to pay for a subscription, you know, a subscription model for $10 a month on Spotify and $10 on Amazon or whatever it is. You get all the music for that price. So now all the music is essentially at your disposal, which is great for the consumer, but not very good for the producers and for the creators. So how are musicians changing that conversation? Well, in order to survive, they have to start thinking differently. So the way they make their money now is touring, which now is going to be a problem, which is merch, which is personal engagements or take a picture with me after the show, kind of thing for $100 or, you know, meet and greets. That was how they were making money. And then, of course, sponsorships, giant sponsorship deals, things like that. That's how musicians were starting to be able to make money. But now a lot of that's going away. And now all they have is streaming, which is nothing. You can't survive off of that. So that's exactly what is happening at our industry. So now there's such a devaluation of movies that, and this is just completely threw the gas on the fire because I was just watching, I just watched Onward, the new Pixar, Disney Pixar movie on Disney Plus this weekend. It got released last week. 2 weeks earlier, it was released on TVOD, Premium TVOD.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, okay, they're going to keep that there probably for a month and a half, 2 months. And then they might release it out for rental, you know, normal TVOD. And then no, they said, screw it. And they went straight to their streaming platform. So that was, they only had basically 2 weeks of premium and they said, no, we're good. Let's just put it on our Disney Plus platform.
Okay.
That only makes sense right now because they're trying to acquire customers. They're trying to acquire subscribers. But when they hit that mass, what is that called? Moment of mass that can't grow anymore. Yeah. That's where Netflix is kind of at.
Right. In the US, that's where they come
in. Yeah. They're like at 130, 140 million. Subscribers in the US alone or something or more than that, they're starting to get to the point in the US that like everyone's got it. Yeah. So if everyone's got it, then, and if I'm assuming as soon you know, 150 million people will have Disney Plus. So at that point, there is no more growth. There's no more subscribers. Maybe you can go international. Maybe you can do other things. But in this, the English-speaking market, there's not going to be much more. So you can hit mass, a critical mass. There it is. You're going to hit critical mass. And at that point, where's the economics of that? So now I just have to create this high-end content to keep you. Not to, you know, so if I spend $200 million on a movie for my streaming platform, that's basically just there to keep you and maybe attract a handful of other people. It's not going to make economic sense. So there's going to be a bubble. There's going to be a point where I don't know, like, what's going to happen. TVOD is pretty much dead in general. Okay. Transactional video on demand is pretty much dead as a general statement, especially for independents, unless you have a specific plan marketing, and I could talk a little bit more about my book in a minute about how to get that audience. When was the last time you rented an independent film?
I usually either stream it directly, an independent. I usually find them here on Netflix
You wait for it as part of your subscription somewhere, whether it be Showtime, Amazon. Hulu, Amazon, YouTube, YouTube TV, wherever it might be. That's where you're going to look for, because you're like, I could just wait, because there's just too much content. There's too much great content out there. You don't need to wait.
So much.
So unless there's some sort of emotion attached to the title that you're looking at, you're not really going to go out your way to rent it, let alone buy it. Because that's a holdover from the days of video stores, renting and buying.
Yeah.
That's a holdover. So, and there's a whole generation who doesn't understand that. There's like, why would I want to buy it? I have access to it at all times. Why would I want to buy it? So TVOD essentially is dead. I think TVOD still makes some money for the big studios because they still have a premium product that people want. Like, people want to see Avengers right away. They want to see the next Fast and Furious or the next James Bond or whatever that big studio movie is. And they might rent it. And some of the older generation will buy it. But I promise you, in 20 years, no one's going to be buying this stuff anymore, not digitally anymore. It's just not gonna be a thing. So since there's no TVOD, there's no transactional, then there's no real rentals anymore.
Right.
Then you got to go to SVOD for subscription, or as part of a membership of some sort. So now there's no money to be made in SVOD. It's very, very difficult to make money in SVOD unless you are a big studio getting a big upfront, MG, things like that. But the world was getting difficult 3 months ago. I can only imagine where we're going to go 3 months from now. And then we could talk a little bit about predatory film distribution and all that after, if you want.
Yeah. So expanding on what you just said, I started looking up some of these movies that have been getting released, and you know more about Hollywood, way more about Hollywood than I do. Mm-hmm. But from what I understand, some of these, I'm not going to name any names, like Steven Spielberg, they weren't crazy about people receiving, Netflix films that were never released in theaters, were released only on Netflix, created by Netflix. I'm wondering, what are their budgets? Because those films are phenomenal, right? Mm-hmm. They're releasing some phenomenal stuff, and only to be released on their platform. Do you is that what you're saying, that this is where this is going, where everyone's just going to start creating their own content? And if so, I'm looking up some of their budgets that they're creating these films in, because they have some fantastic stuff. And one would think, like, if it's super, super financially, I guess if it makes more financial sense to release it in theaters, then why wouldn't they go that route? If not, is it solely to maintain their viewership, to get more subscriptions? And that is their model, to get more people subscribed to their platform. So they have to release this stuff for free, because I feel like nobody would subscribe if they're only releasing it in theaters, then back on their platform.
So Steven Spielberg and Chris Nolan and those kind of guys who are really, trumpeting the whole, it's not cinema unless it's in a movie theater.
Right.
Kind of thing. That is their opinion. And, and I, both of them are probably two of my favorite filmmakers of all time. Yeah. They're fantastic. And
I love Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, Nolan's amazing. And he thinks the theatrical experience is something to be held onto. And I agree with him 100%. You can't, if you see a Nolan film in IMAX and you see it at home, it's a completely different conversation.
Yeah.
But the big difference is that there's not many Nolans out there. There's not many people making that kind of spectacle out there. But there is something to be said, and I don't think there'll ever be a time that we don't have a theatrical experience in one way, shape, or form, whether that be a very premium $50 a ticket scenario like Broadway is, because it's something very unique and very special. But the way it was before, I don't think it's going to be that way moving forward. And Spielberg is trying to hold on to what he holds dear, which is his generation. And, you know, but look at Scorsese. Scorsese went to, with Irishman, to Netflix. Why?
Because that's the movie I was trying to think of.
Yeah, because nobody into Hollywood would give Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci a mob movie the budget to do what they needed to do to get the movie out there. And the reason why is because Hollywood is not in that business anymore. Hollywood is in the business of IPs, of big tent poles. That's the only thing that they have. They can't compete in the low budget world. Unless you're doing a Blumhouse kind of situation, which he has with Universal and those kind of those kind of really more genre-ish films. But for the studios, they can't afford to take a risk on a $200 million plus mobster film. In today's world, it just doesn't make sense to do that in their economic model. But on Netflix's side, they are willing to spend that kind of money and give Martin Scorsese carte blanche to do whatever he wants to do. So now Marty's going, well, I get my money, I get my budget, and I've got creative freedom. You know what? I really do like the theatrical experience, but no one else is doing it, so I'm going to play over here. And that's what he did. And that's exactly what he did. Now, for Netflix, the reason why Netflix, it works for Netflix is, one, they're leveraging future subscribers. They're leveraging future growth to pay for this. Netflix is in major debt. They're leveraged up to the tilt. You know, so they are extremely vulnerable.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Oh, they're extremely they are extremely vulnerable, because unlike all these other studios like Amazon and Apple and the other big players coming on board, HBO, Max that's coming on, these other streaming services that are coming on, they are diversified. That means that if Disney Plus goes away tomorrow,
Disney's still good.
Yeah. If HBO goes away tomorrow, Time Warner's okay. If Apple Plus TV Plus goes away, Apple's aight. But if Netflix's model, if they stop getting subscribers or lose subscribers, their entire model is gone. They are not a diversified company, so they're extremely vulnerable. They have one revenue stream. So they have all their eggs in one basket, essentially.
Very true.
It's a very dangerous model. So I do believe that Netflix will be purchased. They will be acquired by somebody. And I don't know when, but soon. I do believe that Sony is going to be taken. It's going to be eaten up by somebody. I think Paramount and Lionsgate's going to be eaten up by somebody. I mean, look, Fox was just bought out by Disney. Fox, one of the oldest, biggest movie studios ever.
Disney's was just a giant, man.
They just bought it. So if Fox could be purchased, and what do you think Lionsgate's chances are? You know, and I think at this point, Lionsgate, Paramount, and Sony are looking for someone to buy them. And Apple is sitting there waiting. They got cash ready to go. You know, if Google wants to show up, Google can buy it. And like, you know what? We're going to get into the game now. How much do you want? How much? $400 billion? Sure. Would you like cash or gold bullion? Like, what do you want? So, you know, Google's flush. Apple is flush. Amazon could easily come in and buy one of these places and just take over if they want to as well. So that's what that business model makes sense. But it's a business model that there's a clock ticking on the Netflix model. And I was saying this a year ago, that this boom in content that we've been seeing, like everyone's spending obscene amounts of money and buying off complete, you know, content from, you know, series from here and complete libraries from that person. And they're just spending money, because they're just trying to, right now we're in the Wild Wild West. We're trying to attract as many subscribers as possible. But once that's done with, because that's good, we're going to get to critical mass on that. Then it's going to be done. And also, how many of these things are we going to subscribe to? Like, I might subscribe to HBO Max because, well, okay, they have the friends reunion, so I have to watch that. But they also have a bunch of other stuff that they're going to be creating. So like, is it makes sense for me to spend an extra $10 a month on that as well, you know, or not? You know, I got Disney Plus because I have kids.
Now that's the platform for kids, apparently.
No, that's it. And then, but they also have Mandalorian, and they also have every single Marvel
which
film,
which I just
also,
I just watched.
Which is, you know, it's awesome. You know, it's you know.
No, I mean it's incredible that all these that they came out and actually at the perfect time too, because I mean obviously with what's going on now, the more streaming services, the better.
Yeah, it's the time for streaming. This is the time for streaming. Streaming's light to shine is where we're at right now, and it's doing well, and people are finding. I mean, look at Tiger King, and I mean, I could talk about Tiger King for an hour. So don't get me started. I am obsessed with Tiger King, as everybody else is. I love Tiger King. I thought it was just so ridiculous. I can't. Don't get me started. Please.
It happened in our backyard, man.
Well, of course, because listen, man. Anytime crazy shit happens, it's always Florida. Like, it's seriously, dude. Like, I was like, hey, you know that guy who was sending the pipe bombs to everybody? That Trump guy who was sending pipe bombs.
Yeah,
to all
I heard about that.
And then I swear to God, when I saw it, oh, we caught him. And I said to myself, it's in Florida. Watch, it's in
Bet
Florida.
It's like, in Florida.
And I'm like, oh no, it's in Plantation, Florida, where I was born. Okay,
oh,
great.
Oh man, that's a good one. That's right in the gut right there, man.
I'm like, that shopping center. Yeah, I used to shop there when I was in Florida. Man. Like, it's like, come on, dude.
Come on, guys, give us a break.
No, it's always, I don't know
so
why, man.
Funny.
But yeah,
it's so funny.
When I saw Tiger King, I'm like, oh, it's in Oklahoma. I said to myself, it's going to hit Florida somehow. It's going to come down to Florida somehow. Watch. And I was like, I'm watching
Homestead,
something.
Man. I'm like 10 minutes from Homestead.
Who knew there was tigers down there, right?
I know, right? That's insane. That's insane, man. You know, it's funny, though. I watched Tiger King, and it was phenomenal. I mean, the story itself was just like, wow. I didn't know a person like this even existed. This guy was insane. But you know what documentary still is number one to me? Mm-hmm. Is Making a Murderer. Like the docuseries.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I never saw it, but I heard it's fantastic.
Wow. You got to see that, man. That thing is like, wow. Like, wow, but, wow. Like, for sure, Tiger King, like, it's up there. But
so,
Making
so
a Murderer.
So look at that. Look at that model now. The docuseries. That wasn't a thing. That wasn't a thing.
That
before.
Wasn't a thing.
Not a real thing. You know, there was occasional here and there, and they're the Ken Burns ones and things like that, but that nothing like this.
Yeah, Ken Burns.
And
like
this. And this is Netflix's, Netflix has this on lock. Like, there's nobody out that can do docuseries like Netflix right now. And they've been doing it for a while. I've watched a bunch of these docuseries on there as well. It's a very interesting and exciting time as far as the streaming world is concerned. But the clock, I feel, is ticking, and there will be a critical mass. I think after this corona thing passes, there's not going to be the money that was being spent before. So I think the entire industry, as a general statement, is going to go through a very, very difficult time because production is going to slow down, and there's a lot of people who rely on the system to survive, rely on those gigs. I mean, you've been outside the system. You work, you know, as an independent, you know, working with clients and things like that. And there's still going to be need for commercial work and music videos other kind of – there's always going to be need for that. But the pool is going to get much more competitive because a lot of people who were out of that side are going to be forced back into it, and now you're going to be competing with a lot of other people. So now it's all about relationships. It's about, you know, this and that. And it's just going to be a very interesting few years going forward. Without question.
It's crazy. Tell me about, you wrote a new book.
Yes.
And I believe it pertains a little bit to this, to what we're discussing. So tell me about that.
Yeah, so my new book is called Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, and here's if you're watching it, there's a copy of the book right there, and nice. It came out in December, already became a bestseller very quickly on Amazon.
Congratulations, man.
Yeah, I was super excited about that. You know, I I didn't just release the book. I released a website. I released a podcast. I released a YouTube channel. Fantastic. I released a bunch of content around the concept of the Filmtrepreneur method.
What's the name of the podcast?
Filmtrepreneur.
Filmtrepreneur. I assumed that already, but I forget. So tell me about it. What content
can people expect there? So basically, the Filmtrepreneur method I came up with is how to look at filmmaking in a completely different way, where filmmakers have been taught that the tough part is making the movie. So they teach you all about the ins and out, the cameras, the DP, the acting, the writing, all that stuff. And they teach you how to create the product.
Right.
But generally they don't teach you anything else, because the model that we've been taught, or the model that has been spouted about, you know, the story or the myth that Hollywood has been talking about for the last 100 years, is you make the movie, then you hand it over to a distributor, sell your film to a distributor, and then they take care of the business side of things.
Yeah.
And you just take care of the artistic side. And we'll take care of you. Don't trust us. The check is in the mail. And that was basically the model that we've been set. Well, I started seeing in it through my work at Indie Film Hustle, I started seeing that breaking down constantly. And I had my own experiences with distributors and just trying to generate revenue from my own art and my own films. Mm-hmm. And I started seeing that there wasn't a model that made sense anymore. It was very difficult to do this. And if you went down the traditional route, which is going through a traditional film distributor or sales agent or producer's rep or something along those lines, the chances of you recouping your money was extremely very, very small. And making money, God, that's just like a miracle. If I know people who were selling they made a movie for $150,000. They say, hey, I got an MG, which is a minimum guarantee from a distributor, for $30,000. And that's a success.
Wow.
I'm like, what other world and what other business does a loss of $120,000 on a project
make sense? No business would take that.
Exactly. So I started to analyze what was working, and started looking at these case studies of these filmmakers, because I've interviewed so many people over the course of the years on my podcast, that I started to see what was working and how is working outside of the normal way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And I had experience with that myself, selling my own projects in a different way outside of the system. And as I started to put all of this data together, I kind of came up with a concept I call the Filmtrepreneur method, which is using the movie itself. I mean, this is not revolutionary, but I just gave it a twist. Using the movie itself as a lead generator, essentially, to create multiple revenue streams through either ancillary product lines and or services that you can provide that you can control that are outside the system. So with the Filmtrepreneur method, you could still make a movie, and if you still want to go with a distributor, you can, and I teach you how to avoid the predatory stuff, and we could talk about that more in detail later, but you can go that way, but that's one revenue stream as a part of an entire ecosystem that you create. So what Drew Marvick did with his movie Pool Party Massacre, which is an 80s slasher movie, he did it for an extremely low budget. He shot the whole thing over the course of a year, and it's a pool party massacre, so they're outside in a pool so during the winter. So they started in the summer, ended off somewhere in the winter and the fall. Right. And so people's hair changed. You could see breath.
Oh, wow.
The continuity was a little all over the place, but for that kind of crowd, it makes sense. They don't care about that stuff. They were just having, it's a fun movie to watch. But what he did differently is what he understood that he had a niche audience. His niche audience, which is horror fans who like 80s slasher films. And that is the main pillar of the Filmtrepreneur method, is understanding the niche audience. The niche audience is the most powerful thing you have as an independent filmmaker or a filmtrepreneur. In the sense is this. If you are, like we were talking about these big studio movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, oh yeah, Avengers and all this kind of stuff. Well, there was a movie that came out a little while ago called Game Changers for me, which was a documentary about vegan athletes. It was produced by James Cameron and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jackie Chan. Wow. And I really wanted to watch it.
Yeah, I saw
it. And because I had an emotional connection to that film, everything else faded away. All the $1 billion of marketing that was being thrown at me, it didn't matter, because I had an emotional attachment to watch this film, because it was something important to me that I wanted to see for whatever that reason is. But it was an emotional attachment to me. And that cut through all that marketing that easily because it was attached to me emotionally and it was a niche that I was interested in. Because I don't know about you, if you're interested in surfing and a surfing movie pops by or a surfing documentary pops by, it's going to probably pop out to you. Same mm-hmm. thing for your skateboarder, if you're a cook, or whatever niche is, whatever you're interested in. That's the power of the niche. So I always say the riches are in the niches for that reason. So he understood his niche very well because, like I say in the book, he's a card-carrying member of the 80s slasher horror film guys. Yeah. So what he did was he understood his audience so well because he was part of that audience. He was part of that niche audience. So how did he sell it? So he did go through a traditional distributor to get it on the platforms and the SVOD and all that stuff. But he carved out some rights for himself. So physical media himself. I think he can sell it on his own website. I'm not sure. But things like that. But everything else was given out to the distributor. And I know that distributor, by the way, and he's actually one of the good guys. He's one of the few good distributors I know. So what did he do? He understood his audience so well that he went to thrift shops in the area and bought out all the old Disney clamshell movies like Pinocchio and Sword of the Stone and Little Mermaid, right? He'd take them home and then he would record his movie over those movies. He would rip off the stickers and put his sticker on. He would put his insert on and all of a sudden he had his VHS copy that looked like something out of the 80s that he could sell to his audience. And the cover art that he created, the poster art he created, was designed by a guy who used to do horror covers for VHS tapes back in the 80s. So when he saw that, that was the reason I even spoke to him because he emailed me. I get emailed every day by people wanting to be on the show. But when I saw that poster art, I was like, this guy understands what he's doing because it was so good and so well done. And that was a place where he spent a little money that now he's selling T-shirts, hats, posters. And then people in that niche would look at that and like, oh, that must have been a movie I didn't see in the 80s because it was just so well done. So then what did he do? He goes to horror conventions and sells out of these limited edition VHS tapes. Then he had tin lunch boxes with all this stuff. He had an action figure, a headless bikini girl action figure that he created for it. He had all these product lines that he was able to make. And then, we get into the numbers of it. You go, okay, man. So you go to a horror convention and you have a DVD or a VHS, let's say a DVD, and that DVD cost you, 50 cents, 70 cents to put together. Can you go to a horror convention and sell a badass T-shirt with a cool design on it and a DVD for $35? And he goes, yeah, I sold them all day. He goes, so if you sold 100 of those in a day, in a weekend, it's $3,500. He goes, yeah, that makes sense for that kind of movie because his budget isn't $200 million or even $100,000. But he kept his budget so low that it made sense. So another pillar of the Film Entrepreneur Method is keep your budget low, as low as humanly possible by still being able to create a viable product for the audience that you are creating this content for. That is a different, completely different mindset than what filmmakers are used to going down that path. And then creating, and everyone always says, T-shirts and hats. Well, that's low-hanging fruit, You got to kind of create something very good. That's low-hanging fruit. Everyone does that stuff. But, could you do, if he's going after a horror niche, could he create a course on how to do horror makeup or blood effects or, start thinking outside the box on different products, digital products or physical products that could be sold to that audience? Could he also create a service like, hey, I'm a film director. I have a production company. Do you want me to help you produce your horror movie? Do you want me to help you do post on your film? And all of a sudden, that one $5,000-$10,000 movie generates a $20,000 gig for you doing post on a movie.
Yeah.
That's a different model. That's a different way of looking at making movies because it's only been like you get your movie. Here's the product. I only can make money by selling this product. That's not the case. If you do a complete ecosystem, you start thinking about this stuff all the way back and build an audience and be able to understand who you're going to try to sell to and have these services and being of service to that audience in whichever way that audience wants. The product lines, the services are endless depending on the niche and what that niche wants. And I, you know, I use horror, I use my vegan chef movie, which, you know, you're creating vegan courses and cookbooks and all this stuff. And I use case studies of movies have done things like that. There's a movie that was about swimmers. They were selling swim caps with the logo on it. That's something very specific to them. It's thinking so, differently. Yeah,
that's fantastic. So you're talking about like making a small little community around your film or your project.
Business. Yeah. Wow. It's a business. You're creating a business around your project. And if you're smart, you can start leveraging each project to build more and more. Tyler Perry did this. You know, that's how he started. He started off with one movie, and then now he built up a huge library of content that's aimed at a specific demographic, which is essentially African-American women is his core demographic, but African-Americans in general is a little bit bigger version of his niche audience. There's a filmmaker called Mark Harris who has about 20 movies. He shot 20 movies in the last 10 years, started budgets of $5,000. Now he gets up to about $50,000, $60,000, $100,000. He's licensing his films to BET, to different streaming services. He's constantly licensing himself. He owns everything. He doesn't go through a distributor. Wow. And the way he used to make money, and the way he started making money, is he would burn a DVD, and then he would put together a poetry reading. I'm not kidding you, because that was his audience. He put together a poetry reading and a plate of food. So for $30, you would get a night of entertainment, a dinner, and his movie. So now you see all of a sudden it's thinking That's different. Crazy. And now that filmmaker, who's basically kind of like a mini Tyler Perry, he's looking for a backlot. He's starting to build out a backlot in his hometown of Chicago. He's starting to buy out studio space that he's going to start building because his business is supporting a community of filmmakers that work with him all the time. And he's very responsible for that. And same thing that Tyler Perry done. But he's done it on a very indie level. And he's making movies with stars that you would recognize. Not monster stars. We're not talking about like Will Smith or anybody like that. But people that have been in television, have been in other movies that you start seeing like, oh, man. But it took him a minute to get there. And that's the thing. Everything I'm talking about, man, it's going to take work. It's going to take time. This is not sex. This is not sexy. This is not the sexy part of this industry. But if you want a sustainable career, I feel personally – that it makes more sense to build a business that generates revenue for you on a passive state in a passive way, where you're not dependent on the next gig, or somebody else giving you that check. And there's nothing wrong with doing that, but I like to have a little bit more freedom with what I'm doing. So when I had my production company, my production company and my post production company, I would still do that while I did Indie Film Hustle. Where now I've shut down my post house, I've shut down my production company pretty much, unless I want to do something for my own stuff, or if a project shows up that I want to do. And now I run my online business full time, and it generates that passive revenue stream for me while I'm providing a service to an audience. So the Filmtrepreneur Method is built around that, and you could do it. You don't have to start a podcast and do all of this stuff. That's a different model, but you absolutely could. There's no reason why it's an option. If you're going after a very specific niche, let's say zombie movies, if you're a zombie dude, like you love zombie horror movies and you're a zombie horror filmmaker, it wouldn't be a bad idea to start a Walking Dead podcast, which you could then leverage quickly a huge audience that's into the content that you want to create. And every week you talk about The Walking Dead, and at the end of every week, hey, by the way, guys, I'm making a movie, a zombie movie. Hey, if you guys want to check it out, here it is. And now you've built that fan base, and that could be leveraged into horror, you know, a larger niche of horror and things like that. But this takes thought. Mm-hmm. This takes planning. And the book, I lay it all out, very detailed blueprint, step by step, with case studies at every single point of the Filmtrepreneur Method. I have multiple case studies showing you people in the real world who are doing this. And what I've come up with the Filmtrepreneur Method is essentially what Walt Disney did. It's essentially what George Lucas did. It's not a new concept, but it is a new concept at the indie level. There's a difference, because I could talk to you about Disney being diversified and have revenue streams that has Disney Plus. I could talk about all that all day, but you're like, yeah, that's nice, dude, but I don't got $80 billion.
Right, right, right.
I wanted to create a resource that had it, had tools at the indie level. So everything in here, I'm talking about, you want to create online courses, I give you 3 or 4 websites to go to. You want to create merch, here's where you go. You want to understand affiliate marketing, this is where you go for that. If you want to do, you know, if you want to create sponsorships, this is how you create that. And I lay it all out for you at a very indie level, like with like as indie as possible, that anybody can do it. And that's what I thought was missing in the marketplace. And based on the response of the book has gotten, and the podcast and everything else I've been doing with Filmtrepreneur, I've apparently hit a nerve, and it is helping a lot of people think differently about how they make movies, because it was brutal 2 months ago.
Wow.
I can only imagine where we're going to be 2 months from now and 2 years from now.
And I feel like your book could not have come in a better time. In a better time, where people are not, obviously we're in a bad situation now, but coming out of this, like you said earlier, people are going to need this information more than ever, because everyone's going to have to rethink their methods of distribution, of how they go about their, I guess, businesses. I get a lot. I get people ask me all the time, is film school worth it? You know, should I pay all this money to go to film school? And I'm like, man, honestly, in today's day and age, I can't say yes. I just can't, not for that much money. What I tell them, though, I say, look, take some business classes, you know, take, because you're going to be going through a lot of business stuff that you could be a phenomenal videographer, filmmaker, whatever, but you're going to be dragged through the coals with regards to like business, and you're going to be going through so many issues with that. So learn business, learn marketing. Marketing, I took a marketing class in college, and it actually became very valuable. I learned a lot there that I actually still apply today in my business. And even then, like when I do business, and again, I do documentary filmmaking, but I, you know, obviously I have to do some commercial work for my clients, and I still apply, like I have to give them a sort of a helping hand in kind of their methods and strategy and tactics with regards to approaching marketing. And that stuff that I learned in marketing class, in my marketing class in college, still applies today. So that's the business marketing and things like that are very, very valuable. And it seems like you've taken that in depth and applied it to this book, which is very, very interesting.
Look, as a general statement, people need to understand business and understand the business side. I mean, the business side of all of it. Because I've literally in the last 6 months, I've probably read about 30 to 40 different business books. It's something I've really delved into very heavily, and understanding what is done is like, you lose so much money. There's so much bleeding of money and revenue in your daily life that you just don't know. And because you don't understand the way the game is played and the rules of that game, then you're not going to, you just are set up to lose. It's like going to that. It's like going to the casino and sitting down at a blackjack table, and you know the rules of blackjack. Like, you think you know the rules of blackjack, but there's so many different little things that you don't know about. How is there somebody who makes a living playing blackjack and you can't? Mm-hmm. It's not like a physical thing. It's not like a professional athlete. They have something that they understand about the game differently. They know things that you don't know, and you have to educate yourself about that. And that's the same thing about this business in general, but this business specifically. The movie industry in Hollywood is built to take advantage of you. It is designed to take advantage of the creator, to be, it's predatory in nature. Just in nature, it is. It's in nature to take advantage of the newcomer, to take advantage of talent, of the artist, of the creator. And it takes a special kind of creator or filmmaker or writer to, and by the way, also have someone working with them to kind of help guide them through that process, whether that be an agent, a manager, a producer, or someone along those lines, that takes them under their wings to, for them to survive and to get through. It's extremely, extremely difficult to do. And that's, but they don't sell that. They don't sell that at film school.
Oh, no.
They sell you, that you're going to be the next Spielberg, the next Nolan, the next Fincher, the next Tarantino. That's what they sell you. But they never tell you, how are you going to make a living? How are you going to be able, what do you want to be a director? How are you going to get a, your first job? Don't talk to me about your job placement department here. I can go get my own internship after I've spent $50,000 a year, you know, walking out with $100,000 in debt. For look, and this is this will be my final thing on film schools, because I went to film school. I went to Full Sail, and when I went, it was $18,000.
Oh man, that ain't cheap
for my degree.
Full Sail is not cheap.
No, but when I went, it was $18,000. So what did I learn? And for that $18,000, how to make a great cup of coffee and how to wrap cable. Those were the two big takeaways I got, and a lot of great war stories that I can sit down with an editor and talk about, a CMX 3600, a Grass Valley, a montage editing system that was editing on 3.1, all this kind of stuff. I could talk about those things because that's the only experience I had with those systems. Other than that, I learned everything else I needed to learn on the street, on the job, working.
Mm-hmm.
So was the $18,000 worth it? You know, probably not. It was a lot of fun. I met a lot of cool people. It was experience. I did gain a lot of experience on set and things like that. But in today's world, that same education will cost you $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. Look at the ROI. What is the return on investment? And the ROT, the return on time. So if you're going to spend 2 to 3 years of your life spending, let's say, on the low end, to go to a decent film school, $60,000, $70,000 total. Jeez. And it's actually more than that probably. But let's say it's $60,000 total. How long will it take you to pay that money back? Because you can never get rid of it, ever. It's basically strapped to your neck. It's like having a mortgage but no house.
Mm-hmm.
So now, how many years is it going to take you to get a job that's going to allow you to pay that off? You know, how long is it going to take you to pay off? Period. So if you start doing the math, you're like, well, it took me a few years out of school before I started making any serious money. And I was lucky, and I was in a different time and in a different market and different everything. In today's world, I can't imagine trying to do what I did back then. Those opportunities didn't exist. So you have to ask yourself, how long is it going to take for me to get a decent job? How long is it going to take me to move out of my parents' house and live on my own and support myself? As a filmmaker, working, and it could be working as a filmmaker, it could be working in an office at a post house, whatever it might be. How long is it going to take? And then out of that monthly income that you're going to make, how much can I put away to the $60,000? Is it going to be $1,000 a month? That's 5 years.
That's
if you did $1,000 a month, and I'm not even talking about interest.
Oh,
so
man,
it's probably longer than that. So start doing the numbers and you go, man, it's going to take me a decade to get rid of this. Is it worth it? Did that education jumpstart your revenue that you're going to be able to make in the business? That's the question you have to ask yourself. So look, I know I have so many doctors in my family. It's crazy. So they spend $150,000, $200,000 for their education. But when they get out, there's a system in place to get them working. There's a system in place to get them paid back. Then they'll have that paid back in 5 years, 6 years. It's set up. The system is set up that way.
Yeah, even their starting pay is significantly higher than any filmmaker's starting pay.
Oh, God, yes, of course. I mean, so there's a system for that kind of education.
Yeah.
You know, like I have a friend of mine who's a social worker, and she was going and she was telling me, oh, yeah, I had an intern from USC. I go, how much did she spend on her thing? Oh, she spent $120,000. $120,000 for social work masters. And my friend happened to get the exact, by the way, my friend got the exact same social work masters from FAU.
FAU.
In Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? And she paid $18,000 for that. And wow. This USC graduate was her intern. Do you see? Social work also.
Oh my gosh.
So social work also doesn't have the ROI. Do you need to get spend $120,000 to get a social work master's? Probably not. Is it cool? Is it nice? Yeah, but it doesn't matter. An FAU degree is as good as a USC degree. It's not going to get you a job more or less. It's not mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So that's all you have to think about, man. What's the ROI of film school? If you can go to a film school for $2,000-$3,000, go to your local community college, pick up a couple classes, you know, take a class here or there to kind of teach you stuff, absolutely. Go for it. But just look at the price. Because right now, man. Dude, like I'm in the education space. So Indie Film Hustle has a lot of education. I have Indie Film Hustle TV, which is a streaming service that has thousands of hours of education for filmmakers. That's one way to learn. And the way to really learn is to do. So if you've got $10,000, go make a film. I promise you at the end of it, you're going to learn a whole lot more and you'll have something that you could possibly sell as opposed to going to school and dealing with all that stuff. That's just my opinion.
What I would recommend to people, as someone that didn't go to film school, I guess to start the way that I did, is to find somebody, find a mentor, and just offer yourself for free. Be a PA for free. People ask me to be PAs for free all the time. I've never had a PA for free. I always end up paying them. Paying them something. If I'm getting paid, they're getting paid. I never let anyone work for free for me because that's what my mentor told me. I offered to work for free, but he paid me. Even if it's $100 a job, you know, he paid me.
Even if it's gas money, it's $50, right. It's $30, something.
And but even then, that's besides the point. The education was priceless to me. Mm-hmm. That what I learned on set, etiquette, how people treat each other, what to do, what not to do, what to stay away from, you know?
Right.
Those are the things that super, super important. One of the things that took me a while to learn because I didn't go to film school is simply terminology. And I eventually learned all that stuff, but a lot of the terminology. It's
on the set.
Right. It's stuff like that where. I'm here, you know, CTO, CTB, you know, things like that where I'm like, what the heck is that? So a simple Google search told me what it was.
You have an iPhone, dude. Like exactly. You can learn it real quick.
And I've done that before where a client has asked me for, OTFs. I'm like, what the heck is an OTF? They're telling me through email, we're going to need you to do some OTFs. And I'm like, what's OTF? And then I start looking at what OTF production, like, oh, on the fly interviews. Like, I'm like, what the heck? Okay. Yeah, I can do that. I know how to do that. I've always done that. It's just I didn't know the terminology, which was hilarious. But but I do that all the time, even today sometimes. Because I have a London, a client in London. I always, like, every single project we do they somehow, I feel like they make up these terms that I'm like, what the heck is that? It's like every project is something new, but a simple Google search, I'm able to just reply to them back. Like, yeah, sure, I could do that. You know, something.
You'll learn more on set, man, than you will in a film school. Man. I mean, I while I was in film school, I was interning for free at Universal Studios Florida. So I would be on set, and I was working in an office as an office PA on a major TV show that was on Fox. And I worked on Sequest. That old show from Steven Spielberg worked on.
Okay.
And I was you know, pulling cable in a soundstage. I learned so much more working on set and in production that I used to skip school. Really? I'd skip school. Yeah, I'd skip school because I'm like, I'll just take the test, whatever. Like, I'm learning so much. I'm making contacts. It was just made more sense for me. So. You know, I don't want to turn this into a film school bashing session, but no. end of the day, look, man, look, again, if it's an affordable school and it has something to give you and it's an RO and there's a good ROI and ROT on it, absolutely. Yeah. Look, if you're going to get a great some people need structure. They need to be taught in a structural manner like school does. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just another way of going about it. And if that's what you need, then do it. Just try to find the most affordable way to do it to get the most information you can about it, out of it as you can. I always say community colleges, they have great stuff for the basics. And if you don't want to option, what is it? Not option, but a sit-in audit. You can audit classes in major colleges. You could just buy the, you know, just to get the course. And it, or you can go to workshops. There's tons of workshops out
there. There's just so many free content out there just to begin with.
Well, no. Online, yes. But I'm talking about like being able to touch and grab and touch and do.
Yeah.
That's no. Workshops and seminars and things like that. There's so much education out there. Mm-hmm. Look, this book, my filmtrepreneur book, dude, this is like, there's so much. You'll learn more from $20 buying this book than you would from, you know, a year at film school.
Yeah.
Business side, without question. Mm-hmm. To the point where some film schools are buying this in bulk, which is great.
Really? That's awesome.
Yeah, I actually I've gotten a few schools call me like, "Hey, what's the bulk rate?" And I'm like, "Bulk rate? Okay. Wow. Sure, here's the bulk rate."
That's awesome, man.
I mean, because they're starting to see, they're like, "Oh, we have to start providing a different value." Look,
that's good.
Film school's been basically the same since the 70s.
Do you think that they give a false sense of hope for people that
absolutely.
Go there?
Absolutely. Yeah, right. That's the sizzle they've got to sell.
Cuz if they don't do that, nobody's going to go.
If I told this is if film school trailers were true or film school commercials were true, this would be it. I know that you have stars in your eyes, and hey, we all do. If you want to be a filmmaker, we'll teach you some stuff. To be honest with you, most of the stuff that we teach you is available either for free or online for a much more affordable rate than we have. But you'll get hands-on action here. You'll be able to touch some gear if it's at that kind of school. But once you get out, you're pretty much going to be on your own. And the workforce competition is going to be so immense that most of you probably won't make it, and you'll probably end up in another industry after you're done here. There might be 1% of 1% of 1% that might make it at the level that you think you're going to make it at. Because everyone coming in is going to think you're going to be the next Nolan or Fincher or Spielberg or Lucas or any of the big directors. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that's going to be probably a tenth of 1% of all film school graduates around the country, not our school alone, all film schools. Yes. That are going to get to that echelon. Why? Because they're the best of the best of what they do, and there's only so many slots available at that point. It's kind of like everybody can play baseball.
Yeah.
Everyone can play basketball or football, but not everyone's going to be able to play at the professional level, at the highest level of that game.
That's a good analogy.
Same goes for film schools. So that is the reality of what you're walking into. Now, if you still want to sign up, please sign up right here. Oh, and by the way, if you take out loans, you're not going to be able to get rid of them. They're stuck with you for life. Enjoy. That would be a real...
We should do a parody. We should do a parody commercial. Watch it go viral. That would be hilarious. Man, this is so awesome, man. So the name of your book one more time, where can people find it, and what other assets do you have that you mentioned that you had released, like the podcast and whatnot, that people can follow for the book?
So my book is called Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business. And this, by the way, works with not just filmmaking, for feature films, it works with shorts, it works with series, it works with YouTube channels, it works with everything. If you're a content creator, this method can work for you. If you're somebody who already has a business and wants to use it, like you have a production company, you can use the reverse filmtrepreneur method to start generating leads by using the reverse of it. And there's a whole chapter on the reverse filmtrepreneur method in there as well. And you can find the book at filmbizbook.com, filmbizbook.com. That takes you to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and it's available on Audible. If you go to that link and you don't have an Audible account, you can get the book for free. Just sign up through that link and you'll be able to get it for free. Filmtrepreneur.com. Is the website that has all this information that goes really deep into the entrepreneurial filmmaker and the business side of film. Or you can go to filmmakingbusiness.com. It's a quick little hack to get there quicker because a lot of people can't spell filmtrepreneur. Indie well, Film
of
Hustle.
Of course, I'm going to have all this linked. Linked into. But go ahead, Indie Film Hustle. Sorry.
Yeah, Indie Film Hustle is my main hub. It has everything. IndieFilmHustle.com takes us to everything else that I do. I have 3 podcasts going right now: Indie Film Hustle's podcast, Filmtrepreneur's podcast, and the Bulletproof Screenwriting podcast. And a new website that I just launched a few weeks ago called bulletproofscreenwriting.tv, which is dedicated just to the screenwriting and the business of screenwriting side of the business as well. And I have indiefilmhustle.tv, which is the world's first streaming service dedicated to filmmakers, screenwriters, content creators, kind of like Netflix for filmmakers. It has courses, education, movies, documentaries about filmmaking and all that kind of stuff. And I got thousands of other things I could talk about, but that's generally it. Dude, and social media at Indie Film Hustle.
I don't know. One would ask how you do it all, but that could be an entirely new podcast. That's a hell of a lot of content, man. I appreciate you and everything that you do for the industry.
Thank you, brother.
Man, that's fantastic. A lot of Hispanic pride too there also.
Oh man, absolutely. Cubano pride, brother. Cubano pride, man. Absolutely.